Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980. Today we're listening to Captain L.M. Hinchcliffe, DSC, RAN. This talk's entitled Navy Odds and Ends, and gives an account of his experiences in World War II, from the moment of receiving a signal announcing war with Germany until a Japanese surrender. It was recorded on the 2nd of May, 1980, and duration is 1 hour and 20 minutes.
When I finished my last talk, I think I concluded with bumping my head against the leading signalman's head, as we both roared for the voice pipe at about 9 o'clock, expecting the signal total Germany, and we got it. Well, we were off Sydney on patrol. We were the only ship out that night, a pretty wild night, and one of the things that, of course, immediately came into being was the recognition signals. And for those of you who remember, in those days, they not only consisted of a signal letter or letters, but we also had the red, green, and white lights strung up the mast and so on. And I must admit that not one of us thought that we'd be given the challenge by the flagship coming out through the heads, but we were. And I've forgotten why, at a particular time, we weren't really alert enough to push our button, but we didn't. And we started the war off then with a frightful bottle in this vendetta. However, we were eventually sent off to our war station, and that was some miles out to the east of Newcastle. And again, you may remember, I mentioned that a week before the war, there had been a German merchant ship called the Lahn, which sneaked out of harbour on the Friday night, in the middle of the night, and the warpies reported that they had seen down below some 6-inch gun barrels. And of course, everybody thought, well, when they've seen it, they know what they're talking about. And we were raced off to have a look for them. We never did catch them up. But on our way to our war station, a vessel very much like the silhouette of the Lahn turned up. And we snuck up behind him, and this is our first real worry of the war. And it turned out to be a bank liner, and he went to panic stations completely. So we weren't far short of it, I suppose, but there it was. After that little episode, for a couple of days on, I think it was 2 days on patrol, for everybody, we were sent into the nearest ports to show the flag and let everybody see that the RAM was at sea and it had all its guns on board and ammunition. In our case, of course, the bullets were kept in the guardrails, which these days, of course, is anathema to people, but that's where they were. So they could visibly see the fact that we were with ammunition, I'd say. Newcastle turned up one particular point, which no one ever bothered to tell us, and that is that the BHP place there had installed an 8-inch projectile manufacturing plant. And they showed it to us, and they reckoned that in about 3 or 4 hours operation, they could do all our practice ammunition shoots for the 2 8-inch cruisers, they could renew them in that small time. Well, this seemed to us to be a pretty good thing. It should have been spread around a bit. From Newcastle, we returned to Sydney and went off later on to help Adelaide, that mighty battleship that everyone seemed to think that it could do a good job. I suppose she did in the end, but one of the things that caught up with us there was, as we went round into Bass Straits, we were on our way to Melbourne, we decided we'd have to show everybody, including ourselves, how the high-speed destroyer sweep, it was a mine sweep, which most destroyers were fitted with at one time, either the high-speed one or the two-speed one. Well, the old V's and W's had the high-speed, and it hadn't been run in my time in the ship, so we had to do it. Everybody was mustered aft at 1:15, and I happened to be down aft, and the captain was holding the bridge, and looked forward, and there was a black line right across the horizon, typical Bass Strait. Before we could even get the sweep in, we were digging our nose right under. And that night, Adelaide decided he wanted to crack on. We were darkened, and as we passed the prom, a very dim light came out, what ship? We just sent back British warship and left it at that. When we got into Williamstown to fuel, there was a message from the lighthouse keeper. He was terribly sorry to have made us disclose our position, but he could see the sheet of spray going by and wonder what the hell was making it. Well, the result of that sheet of spray was 52 rivets popped in our forward tanks, and that occasioned another rather oddity. The captain decided to give me the handle from Williamstown across to Port Melbourne, and I did all the usual things, and nothing happened. Half astern together, nothing happened. And finally, the captain got over the back of the bridge and bellowed down aft in the usual style and the destroyer, "What the bloody hell's wrong with the engine, Mr. Cook?" And up came Mr. Cook with his head up the thing there, "Bloody oil in the bloody fuel, sir." I think it was the Anchises or something, one of the blue funnel liners alongside watching all this caper, and they were roaring their heads off. But we did manage to get one heaving line ashore and saved ourselves. After that, we completed, and all destroyers were then sent up to Singapore to, all the V's and W's were sent up to Singapore to, for AS exercises. We hadn't got a submarine down in Australia and hadn't had one for some time. They brought up one in 38, I think. And we were going up there for 6 weeks and to come back to Australia. Well, I was away for 4 years. A lot of other people were somewhat from the same time, but we moved on from Singapore to Colombo, and I had my first job then as an embryo doctor in diagnosing that our own doctor had an appendicitis. I don't think he's here tonight, but I often wonder if he really had one, but anyway, someone extracted something from his guts and we left him behind in Penang. And we're in Colombo, and from Colombo, you might remember that the pocket battleships were spreading themselves around the Atlantic at that time, and one of them was reputed to be coming up the east coast of Africa. Quite why, we didn't really know. Anyway, a couple of them were sent down there, and ourselves and Waterhen were dispatched to go to the men. And the poor old B&W, again, some of you might remember, they had what they called peace tanks. Now, in peacetime, these peace tanks are filled with water, and they are wing tanks under the iron deck. But in wartime, you lost the water and you went to fuel. Well, even with these peace tanks, it became patently obvious about a quarter of the way across that an unexpected set was against us, and things were not going to be so easy. We had started off on one boiler only, with absolutely the minimum of auxiliaries going, and no make-up boiler water, no make-up domestic water at all. And about halfway across, an able seaman who'd cracked his coccyx and had been landed in Colombo for a treatment died. And this had a rather unfortunate repercussion later on. So we had to disclose our position because I, being the intelligence officer, knew that Ramillies was somewhere in the area, and we wanted to have this thing investigated because our own doctor had been gone. We were, of course, in the hands of plenty of other expert, and they reckoned this fellow was all right to travel, and we didn't think he was when he came on board, but you can't go against that. However, nothing happened, and that was my first burial at sea. It was a very solemn process when you first come across it, more especially when you're thinking of the circumstances under... Can you hear me at the back all right?
Yeah.
The circumstances under which it occurred. However, we went on, and we got a quarter of a knot set the other way, and it allowed us to get in with 23 tons, I think it was, of fuel remaining, and Waterhen was our consort. He had something like 10, and we were very, very pleased to get into Aden. I can assure you, with no word of the Graff's Bay and no chance anyway of the whole way over from Colombo to Aden of doing anything about it, even if we had struck it, we'd have been sitting ducks. Well, we happened to be the first into the Med of the Australian fleet. We weren't called a scrap iron flotilla then. I think that we should have been, but not really. In many ways, when we look back on it, we were capable of steaming, we were capable of fighting, and we did have, although a destroyer, we had an anti-submarine set which was normally put in a trawler. Why on earth the government did that, I have no idea. I can't even find it out to this day. But as you know, they did get submarines with it. I don't think it was entirely just, because from memory, Stuart got a couple, and I think Voyager got a couple, didn't he, Bill? At least one, anyway. However, our arrival in Malta is still very vivid in my memory. We went alongside some cruiser, and there was a gaggle of brass on the rail, most of whom had a bit of red between their stripes, and they joined board with us, along with a bloody great tomcat who was after our little girl. And the result of the Board of Inquiry on the subject of the able seaman's untimely death was that the captain got a rap over the knuckles, a pretty solid one, for allowing the French letters and the condoms to get mixed up. As for the able sailor, nothing on that on paper at all. Some of you might appreciate the irony of that one. We did a few convoys from Malta to Marseille, to Haifa, to Alex, Port Said, and nothing happened. They were two-ship, troop ship, or horse ships, and still transporting horses in those days. We did have Christmas in Marseille about 3 days later than it should have been, and it really astonished everybody, I think, just how cold it could be up there. There was ice forming in the harbour, and a couple of years before the war, a poll had been taken in the destroyers that were in commission as to whether the little coal stoves that were fitted in the mess decks and fitted in the captain's cabin in the wardroom should remain or be thrown over the side. And the troops all went on your way, you see. The wardroom didn't, and neither did the captain. We were the only people who were warm. It was terribly cold, it really was, and they were completely stripped, of course. After a couple of months of that, I had been selected to go to England to do a long anti-submarine course. And we were in Alex having 10 days lie-off when the signal came through, and the troop ship came in, and I had to go under that night. Well, being a very young two-striper, I had nothing behind me except what I got every fortnight, and I was broke. Alex was quite expensive if you really want to play the game. And no one in the ship had a bean. And when we got into Malta, it was a Sunday, there was not a soul around the place. The paymaster was holed up somewhere, and I hawked myself round all the destroyers, and I managed to get 10 quid, five of which came from Commander Waller, as he was then, and five from about three other people. And that was all I had to get to England. And when we got to France, to Marseille, we went into a troop train, and by the grace of God, the senior major had a
cabin to himself, and he said, "Well, Hewlett was there, you could do with a bit of help. Come on in with me." So I lived in luxury as far as everybody else was concerned, but they fed the sailors, or the troops. They didn't feed the officers in the British troop trains. So every time the train stopped, you'd see a whole gang of officers hanging out the windows and on the platforms and everything else, and as soon as it stopped, off they went. Well, if you're properly organised, one went for food and the other one went for grog. And this is what happened with my fellow. He said, "I can't run very fast, but you go and get the food and I'll get the grog." So I lived pretty well for about 3 days when it took us across France. But again, some of you will remember how terrible it was to try and extract money from the hierarchy. It was a Saturday when I arrived in London. I was upbraided for dragging out the naval officer, naval liaison officer, from his game of golf on the Saturday afternoon. "And why do all you young bastards arrive broke?" That was the actual greeting as he came through the door. And eventually I put in my claim, which I think amounted to £4.16 or something. I got 2 guineas, and the paymaster of the place I was in said, "This is bloody nonsense, you better complain about this," which I did, so I got 31.6. And that was from Alexandria to London with a night in Southampton in a hotel. I hope it's changed. Well, I went down to Osprey, which was then the home of the Aztec world, and it was situated at Portland, on Portland Bill. And as usual, signals had gone adrift, and I was too late for the course that I was supposed to be in. So I spent a most magnificent month in one of the potentate's yachts. It was a thing called St. Modman. And St. Modman is the patron saint of beer drinkers. And this was owned by the chairman and directors of a man, Crossman Paulin, I think, was the actual firm. And a fantastic time. Beautifully appointed, got everything right into the shut, and we had to chuck off daily and go and do our AS exercises in the training squadron. And that gave me a bit of an insight into what I was going to come up against. Well, whilst I was doing my course, Dunkirk evacuation occurred, and the Admiralty especially sent a signal to say that the long AS course was not to be disturbed. All the other specialist courses were sent off, and we had to carry on because the Atlantic battle then had apparently started to impinge itself on their lordships, that it was going to be crucial. We had a moan and were fallen in, given a dressing down. I remember that with 1, 2.5 go, all the rest of the 2 stripers being upbraided by Captain A.S. But we had to man the bill with a platoon drawn from the sailors who were doing their courses and us who were doing a long course. And this used to start at 6 o'clock in the night and go on all night. Who got any rest? You still had to do your course, whichever way you were going. But the heartening thing then was that the number of boats that came along the coast and came in close and say, "Which way Dunkirk?" And that way. Tremendous number of them. The spirit then was really fantastic. And I don't recall anybody holding up in Portland. We had quite a big harbour there, a base really. And the spirit of these fellows who were coming from all over the place, including Ireland. But on completion of my long course, which I might say was salted by quite a few things. The first of the heavy raids on the harbours took place in Portland, and as I'd had a window seat from the word go, I was the eagle or the cockatoo or something, and I fortunately, as far as I was concerned, fortunately, because I could see what was going on. This merchant ship converted to AA, which was down in the harbour, was actually slaughtered. Well, I saw the whole jolly lot of that. And it was quite a lesson in what one can come up against. But at the same time, we had the magnetic mine menace, and the first of the double L sweepers were down there being tried out. it was fairly flat water, and the bottom was fairly flat as well. This is where they were trying them out, but the thumps all day long as they got these mines is pretty disconcerting. On completion of my long course, I was appointed to what I considered to be a very, very fine appointment, and that was to HMS Western Isles. In fact, HMS Western Isles hadn't arrived at the working up base, which was in Tobermory on the Isle of Mull, Scotland. One of the extraordinary things about Mull is that it's right in the direct line of the tail end of the Gulf Stream. And all sorts of things used to come ashore on the west coast there, including, the, you may remember, the I think it was the Arundora Star, which was sunk with about loss of 400 kids or something on their way to America. Well, a tremendous number of the bodies came ashore on Mull. And it was also famous because the Reddings, the Mitfords, probably is a better name for that, Nancy Mitford and so on. Their seat was there, and but quite a few oddities used to go on around there because the Cloak and Dagger boys were pretty well on the top of it, and I came up against them a couple of times, one because I was an Australian and one because I defended a leading signalman from an obvious fellow who was trying to worm information out of him. I don't know whether you've ever been grilled by intelligence, but when you're put in a dark room and all you can see is a great light shining in on you, it is not funny. Fortunately, my conscience is completely clear, and so are my actions, and I'm just proving it, but it's not nice at all. Anyway, this working up base was to be run, I said to be run, deliberately, by Vice Admiral Gilbert Stevenson. He had made his name in World War I as being the head of the Adriatic Patrol. He had over 1,000 craft under his control, and they're all fairly small, of course, but he did a magnificent job there. And when I first met him, which was during the long course, he had a chest full of ribbons from, he's only a little fella, about that high, from round about there on me up to about just over the back of his shoulder, basically. When he came up in Western Isles, it had been reduced considerably. All the Italian decorations, of course, had to be taken away. But Monkey Face, as he was called, he had great grips here, and very much looked like a monkey, great upper lip and so on, was a colossal character. And he was being employed as a commodore, and he brought this funny old steam of the Western Isles, a coal burner, up into Tobermory. I was living in a pub up till then, and one little story there might interest you. The night I arrived, I was again in an impecunious state. I had fourpence, I think, and at that stage in England, you had to pay your bill in the pub before you were allowed to sleep in the bed. And in somewhat fear and trepidation, I pressed the bell in the little parlour, because the pub was only about from here to the projection room, away from the wharf. And an enormous brute came in, shoulders about that wide and high and so on, and I said, "Are you the publican?" And he said, "Fuck." And I said, "Well, I'd like a drink, and would you care for one too?" He said, "No, I'll bring you one." But he brought me one. And I had that, and I pressed the bell again, and I said, "Would you again care to join in the drink?" "No." So I had that one, and then I pressed the bell again. And I said, "Will you give me a hand up the stairs with my bags?" Well, most of you probably remember the old Gieves tin trunk. I only had one. The rest of mine were wooden. I didn't like Gieves trunks. But there it was. We grabbed hold of this, and I was taken to the back end, so I had to push. And he said, "What's this A between the R and the N?" And I said, "Australia, Royal Australian Navy." "You an Australian?" "Yes." "Well, drop it." "I said, what?" "Drop it." "What? Drop your bag." And there it was on the stairs like that. At 3 o'clock, we passed that, crawling up on either side. He having then said, "Ah, I thought you was a Sassenach." The result of that was I never looked back. I was fed like a fighting cock, no matter what time I came in. And later on, when I had a few days leave and another appointment, they heard I was coming up, and they all were there to meet me on the jetty, and they were terribly disappointed when I said I was staying privately. But that's the way we were thought of up there in Lewisburg, in the Highland Country. But, well, the routine for this working up was quite fantastic. We used to have to be on board the ships at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we'd go out to the grounds where we were. We had our submarine exercise area. This is far too small, but
I've had it in this other thing. But Mull, there you can see Scotland.
Yeah.
Mull's there, and there are two little islands. Islay is one, and Col and Tyree, and they form a triangle, and we were exercising there. Why the Jerrys didn't twig that was going on, well, I don't know, because they could have picked off all the escorts as they were coming up for their working up without any trouble at all, but they didn't. And we only had one visitation. I got there end of June and left the end of November. I think we only had one visitation from an aircraft in all that time, and that had obviously lost its way. It was very, very rugged weather that day, and it didn't do anything to us at all. But we'd go out to this ground, we'd carry on with our anti-submarine exercises for possibly two-thirds of the day, and then we had a tiny little 36-foot private launch to tow a target. We'd pop off with that, get back into harbour, doing discharge reloading drills and gun drills and all sorts of things on the way back. And indeed, the sort of thing that in the end we were doing was presenting them on arrival from their base where they'd either worked up or built, they'd either commissioned or built, and present them with a watch bill. All they do is fill in the names right the way through. We found it was so much simpler, and they also found it so much simpler. And especially when one character said, "Well, look, sir, what do I do with all these pay envelopes?" "Well, why?" He said, "Well, that's all I've got. I can't send any correspondence in these." He had 3,000 pay envelopes. And this is the sort of thing that we had to try and iron out. But in the main, they were marvellous. We had from